that day.
Sure.
What can you tell me? You have that photograph, and I believe you have one more. It shows the back of the ambulance, actually shows you sitting in the ambulance. What do you remember about the setting up, or how that became, got converted?
Okay, well, they had these ambulances made in some form or fashion before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is that, like I said, they had a bunch of people who, out of 16, out of the section had 16 people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of expertise was not very deep. Consequently, guys would go out there, unfortunately, and string anything up and would throw a tire jack out in the field, take from the side, a back of the HF, you'll probably see there's a hole that went through there and you could run your RF out. And they would tie the wire onto the jack and try to communicate, and half the time they couldn't communicate. Then we added a command unit. Anyway, what happened was that these things were not very reliable, and so Lewis Wacker and myself, we took and we fixed first one, then we fixed two more like it. We had a total of three. And at that time, the call sign was C-Deep.
What was it?
C-Deep. C-Deep. Yeah, C-S-E-A-D-E-E-P. C-Deep. Yeah. And...
For the ambulance.
For the ambulance. Well, not only for the ambulance, also for this here. This here happens to be a instrumentation truck.
Okay.
Okay.
Big picture of that.
But later we had... it might be in here.
He comes in here.
Yeah. Now this here is Arcom. Yep. And now there we had, of course, UHF and other. Now here we had two big BC-610 transmitters in there.
Mm-hmm.
We had R390 receivers. We had command units. The whole nine. That was basically when we went to a long side remote, like Truth or Consequences or Roswell or wherever we went remote. We would take this van. And we would have poles that we would look to, TV poles we could extend out, you know, about 30 feet, and we'd hang dipole antennas between them and all that. We would put roughly 500 watts into those things, and we would talk back to the base for all our communication, how much heat and free lift and all that kind of stuff. That was all done here. We never or seldom took an ambulance to the launch site.
Mm-hmm.
We might at Holloman,
mm-hmm.
because there we didn't need the power. We're sitting right underneath the runway out here. We're talking right back to the building.
Sure.
Okay. But in the field of recovery, wherever we went, we took these ambulances.
Okay.
Now that went out though in 1960. What was this date on this picture?
I think that's 59. 59 or 60. It's hard to read.
60. But we started, anyway, the ambulance came about when I got there. They had three of these ambulances, and they had one comm van like this, and they had one instrumentation van like that. We took, and in the comm van, Lewis Wacker and myself, we started rewiring these things and cabled them and laced them up and everything else, and still is not near as well as you can see. We ran the cabling up and taped it and all along here. Before, it was just a wire maze. It really was. And they just couldn't talk anywhere. But we took these things all over Arizona, all over New Mexico, all over Texas. And it had HF in it. So we could talk back to base on HF, which we did. We could command the balloon on HF, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
We had a command control unit to actually control the balloon. We had a UHF set. We had VHF. And we had what they call an AONR-6, which was a direction finder, which is the same thing the aircraft used. In fact, it was an aircraft unit that was put in there for a DS set. So we made those things. They were there when I came there. They were just not in the shape they were in later.
So a standard ambulance that was being used for transporting patients and things, would look basically the same, but it wouldn't have all the electronic
none of gear. All that gear in there. That's exactly right.
It would just have two plain areas for laying patients,
you
two
bet.
On each side,
mm-hmm.
like a bunk bed arrangement.
Yep, you bet.
So if you looked in the back of the ambulance, you'd see two bunk beds. You wouldn't see, other than your specialized converted ambulance,
right.
You wouldn't see all that that electronic gear.
Wouldn't have anything like that. It'd be a standard everyday World War II Korean ambulance. That's
now,
right.
Now, one of the things that this particular person who claims to have seen an ambulance at the Walker Hospital, he talks about these two, I don't know what better way to call them, panels. These two panels here.
Yeah.
He describes them as being blue, some kind of blue canoe. So we can see by this picture that these were painted Air Force blue. And they appear to be in that picture too. So, and then there's a writing across here.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any other writing back there? Someone describes there being some kind of foreign writing.
Nope.
Just, yeah. That's
no, periodically you might hang a piece of tape up there and write, make a note or something on there, but there was no standard. That's
so
where he was.
These are blue ambulances, and so I assume that the lettering is yellow. Looks like from the picture you can tell the lettering was yellow. Let's see, so you had electronic gear in the back, you had whip antennas on it, and you can see from the one picture that you guys spray painted or painted over the where the Red Cross was. So
I guess the motor pool lit that. Mm-hmm. We didn't. We sure didn't. But I know we had the motor pool paint these things blue, and they put all new writing on there, and the whole top of the van was yellow, the ambulance was yellow, had a special rack on top of it for all the antennas, and then it had a big number on the roof that the aircraft, so when we was out on recovery, and they could tell what vehicle we were, and also the weapons carrier that we went along with that actually was the recovery people, their top of their vehicle was painted yellow also, and it had a number on it, so they could, the aircraft could always see who was in the field.
So, getting back to the Walker Hospital there, there's been charges that a red-headed captain made some disrespectful comments to a civilian. Did you have any knowledge? Did you see a red-headed captain being disrespectful to anyone while you were there?
Nope. There was a redhead captain on the flight, all right. That was Captain Gittinger.
Was it like brownish red, or was it bright red?
Brownish red, I would say, and pretty thick.
Definitely red.
Yeah, definitely red. But I never saw him make any kind. Even after the flight, he was calm, cool, and collected, and he told us why he had crashed. I mean, he made the choice from what he told us, and what we turned around and saw it, verified everything he'd said, and boom, that was it, you know. He was sure not upset. Now, he might have been personally upset that the other captain got hurt,
mm-hmm.
but that's, you know, that comes with the territory of the job, I guess, mm-hmm. you know. But no, I never saw any commotion at the hospital or anything else. And like I mentioned to you earlier, if this is 1947, that they were saying, Captain Kenyon wasn't even in the service in 1947. This is 1940. This is 59.
That's right.
So
he's still in high school, I think.
Yeah. Somebody's got their wires crossed on this thing.
While you were there at the hospital, I assume you didn't, but I'll just ask you, did you have any contact with any nurses or see any nurses?
We waited outside. Didn't even go inside.
Did you see Did you see any other ambulances there?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope,
did you see anything that looked like a hearse?
Nope.
Okay. Did you see any body that may have looked like they were a mortician?
Nope.
A civilian?
I didn't see anything. I didn't pay any attention to that. We sat out there. We parked our vehicle, and I think we was by the ramp sidewalk area there, and part of the time we was over by our vehicle, and I didn't see anything. I didn't see, I think Captain Kenyon came out one time and said something to to one of the guys in recovery, or one of the people. It might have been to the chopper pilot or to one of our people. I just can't remember that. Mm-hmm. And after we had done whatever we went there to do, whether it was to give them something they had left behind, or tell them everything was cleaned up, and make our phone call back to Holland and say that the site is secure and we're ready to come back. That's basically all we did there. I didn't see anything.
So you guys got back in your converted ambulance.
And drove home.
And then, okay.
That was it. That was the end of the flight.
Right.
And I wished that this was going to be like this. I sure wish I'd taken a lot more pictures.
Well, that's great. That
and wrote a lot of numbers.
That's great.
Meant things down.
Took the ones that you did. Now, getting into another area, since you were there in the balloon branch, after this incident, did you have occasion to go on recoveries of various payloads?
Many.
Many recoveries?
Many.
Okay, let me ask you just a few questions about that.
Probably 100. Okay. Over my time.
Okay, on your various tours.
We normally launched, in those days, about 100 flights a year.
Yeah.
And roughly, you know, anywhere from 90 to 100. And later years, of course, as we got you down to 30, 35, 40 people, that number became 60, 65, 70, 75 flights. Worked a lot of long hours. Yeah, I went on a lot of recoveries.
So when you went, would it be similar to the way you said this mission went? Would they send you out in the field and say, okay, there's going to be a balloon coming over, and then would they help you to get to recover it?
Yeah, the normal procedure. We have several kinds of recoveries, but there's the normal procedure for recovery is, if we launch from Holloman, mm-hmm. then we would, depending on how strong the winds were, how long the flight was going to be, and Mr. Gillenberg would, and his meteorology people would tell us that, if we knew it was going to launch at this time, it was definitely going to go from here to Hobbs, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
We would send recovery, or we, later on it was we, but then, back then, it was they would send recovery, and maybe to either Artesia or Roswell and wait there. You would
so
then...
Where would you wait?
At the Roswell Airport, Artesia Airport, at the Armory, by a cafe, while we'd have coffee or something like that, we'd call back, anywhere. Later on, we would definitely, where we could, when we, these guys had gotten so dependent of going and picking up AT&T the phone and calling back. Well, when we started proving to them that we could communicate from these ambulances, converted ambulances, I should say, then we would just, wherever we found a good spot, we would tell recovery, hey, we're going to stop at the airport in Artesia, we're going to stop there. We could go and have a couple. We knew all the people then. See, we'd be coming over there so regularly. Go and shoot the bowl with them a little bit, have a cup of coffee. We'd set up the antennas, climb up the tower where the rotating beacon is, and we'd call back to control. Because the control center would be manned naturally back there. They would be controlling the balloon. We would then have a radio check and go. So that's one way we could do it. And then we would say, okay, we see the balloon coming up now. Recovery would have the theodolite set up, and they would be giving us, the comm people, the readings of the theodolite. Mm-hmm. We would give the readings to control over our HF radio.
Yeah, you pass it back.
Okay, now it's over us so far, so we would give them, if we're at Artesia and we see it coming up over the mountains here, we would give it to them. Then we'd give them to them maybe to 100 miles out to the east, and we'd button everything up and we'd get in our vehicle and we'd drive to Hobbs. Or Midland, or wherever it was going to be at. There was going to be. Meanwhile, there will also be a chase plane overhead, and we would be talking to the chase plane.
Uh-huh.
And we would, of course, have our DF set on, so when we was in motion, we could still get a DF reading on it if we lost sight of the balloon. Mm-hmm. Visually, then we could, we could always ask the aircraft, "Do you have a visual on the balloon?" "Yeah, we have it." "Okay." So that's how we did it. That day. And many other days, though, the winds aloft were not very strong because the balloon didn't go probably over 10,000 feet,
right.
If that high.
Right.
Because it was strictly low level. It was to train the pilots how to take off and land. and how to use the valve and how to dump the ballast and all that. That's what part of the whole training was for. And so they didn't go very high. And consequently, there was not a whole lot of wind. So we had no trouble taking off when they launched, keeping up with them on the ground and watching them light their flares and all that stuff. So that was it.
So on some of these scientific payloads that they were launching, did you have occasion to go into the area near Roswell for recoveries?
Sure.
Like, would you say regularly or?
Well, we stayed, we'd go to the Armory and stay there and take a shower there. A lot of times when we was out on recovery, they would say, okay, we're going to have a flight, we want you to stay halfway and, okay, we'll pick Roswell, or we would pick Artesia or something like that, and we would stay there, get a motel, or if we didn't have time for that, we would then just hang around and we would put our antenna up and talk back to them at the Armory. I know many times when they hoisted their flag, they hoisted our antenna with it, you know. We'd talk back and then use the Armory and take a shower and whatever. So we did that many, many times, like I say, all over Texas, all over New Mexico, all over Arizona. I've been in these vans right here. Now, it's about 63, 64, we didn't know, maybe 65, we stopped using these ambulances. Mm-hmm. And we used those big convans then, but not even these. Remember the white ones I showed you with the
yes.
other trailer? We used those.
Yeah.
But then we knew they were going to launch them here, and boy, they would be going all the way to maybe Texarkana or Georgia or something like that. We would place one outside Fort Worth area at Texarkana, close enough so we could use the Fort Worth Dallas airports, because of they were real touchy about the balloon flying in airspace. So we could command from there, and then we'd have another one down in Marietta, Georgia. Likewise, we'd have them at Tucson. We would have them at Yuma.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been all over that way.
So if you're standing by, let's just say it's a balloon that's going to go over into the east of the Sacramento Mountains,
mm-hmm.
over there. You're standing by waiting, and then the balloon comes, and then the tracking aircraft give you some instructions. Like, how long would the payload would come down by parachute, and then the balloon would come down on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so how long would it take you from the time it hit the ground till you guys got there to start working on it?
Oh, well, you know, that all depends how far away you are and how much. If it's out in the middle of the boonies, the aircraft never told us what to do, other than when, okay, we just talked to, if we wanted to relay some information back and forth, or if control couldn't get a hold of us, they could get a hold of the aircraft, and the aircraft would relay it to us,
mm-hmm.
okay? But once we terminated, we would either tell the aircraft, or if they couldn't copy control, but because they had the same links in the aircraft, they had HF, VHF, and all that stuff in the aircraft, so they should have been tuned to the same thing. But we would tell them, okay, 10 minutes to cut down. If the balloon was at 70, 80, 90,000, 100,000 feet, cut. Of course, the balloon flies skyward, because when you go into command sequence, you terminate. It takes about a minute and a half. You go through, this is in the later years, not in the early years back then, but once you terminate, you hit the command terminate, and you don't just blow right then. You start the valve opening if you haven't done it already first.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes about 18, 20 seconds for the valve to open. And then you can drop ballast, you turn cameras, you can do a lot of things that would be tied in with a command termination. Anyway, once you terminate, of course, you blow the script between the bottom of the balloon to the top of the parachute. The balloon flies off somewhere, and it's got rip panels on both sides of the balloon.
Mm-hmm.
Two little rip panels with strings inside the balloon. That rip panel comes through the bottom of the balloon, and it is tied onto our chute.
Mm-hmm.
So now when you fire that cannon, actually there's two scripts up there, then you pull the load away from it, and it pulls that string. It's supposed to rip those panels,
mm-hmm.
and the valve is already open, but it still shoots skyward, and then of course it slowly tumbles, and it comes down. And most of it's going to be the parachute down naturally, in most times.
So how would it look when it started coming down? You see this thing falling out?
You just see it big thing falling out of the sky.
It'd be like, what, white?
Yeah, it's whitish, because that's...
And it's in free fall.
It's a free fall, period.
And these balloons were some of them were up, were millions, as you said,
yeah,
millions of cubic feet.
But that's why you didn't cut just anywhere. You picked where you cut. So, number one, we didn't want to cut over some water or something, so we couldn't get to the package. We went on to cut it. In fact, we couldn't fly over base town here. We had to fly south of town.
So then would you try to cut it near a road so it'd be easier for you guys
sure.
to get in?
Well, Duke would say, okay, we know where the balloon is at now. Because we would have it on the radar plotting board up there in the control center, if we had radar on it, depending on how far away it was. Or we would take the triangular positions from our DFs that we told you about. Mm-hmm. And, okay, the balloon is here, and we know the altitude. And Duke say, I know the jet stream here, here, here. And he would know all the winds for, he would take it a composite of every 10, maybe 10, 15,000, 5, 10, 15, like that, what the wind layer was and directions. So he would figure out the chute drift.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, okay, we know we're here, and the balloon's going to drift 20 miles to the south-southeast from here. Okay. Hey, recovery's going to be here, guys. Head for that area.
So you had two places. You had to pick up your payload, and you had to pick up your balloon.
That's a fact. And that's why I said I think it took longer for us to get to the hospital. And I cannot remember going out specifically on that flight and picking that balloon up. I just can't remember. I've been on so many of them. But I know it wasn't... I don't recall the balloon laying right there in that field. It could have. I just don't remember it because he was only 200 feet up. But still, when you cut it, that balloon's going to go. Now, but, did it land next field over? Or I can't remember that.
Now, when you would get to these to the recovery site, either for the balloon or for the payload, would there sometimes be maybe a civilian there or a rancher who maybe saw it and was coming over to see what the heck
sure.
it was?
Sure. You betcha. We always told them.
And you tell them?
Sometimes, if they want the balloon, we'd give them the balloon.
Okay.
That way we didn't have to haul it back.
So would they be surprised? Would they be just wondering what the heck it is?
Yeah, and we said if there's any damage to your property, we would give them a telephone number and they could call Holland Air Force Base and talk to the appropriate people, and they would make sure they would get somebody over there to look at the damage and compensate them for it.
In the project you were working with, was there ever any reason to have armed guards for...
Well, yeah, there was a couple that we had guards, and as a matter of fact, it was on Captain Kinder's flight, but they were because that was to keep all the public and
yeah.
all the media away from
it. I've seen it in the movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, we had that down at Tularosa when we launched one time from down there. And there might have been an AP or two or three out there. That was just to keep people away at a distance so they wouldn't get entangled in our balloons and our instrumentation and all our communications and all that stuff. We flew many secret missions or highly classified missions out there, and we never had any, I don't remember any guards on that.
Coming on recovery?
No, never. I don't ever remember anyone recovering.
When something came down in somebody's field, did you ever have a payload and not the parachute malfunction and the payload hit the ground hard?
Well, yeah, but they had that, but there was one time that one came down in a guy's front yard, hit part of the roof, and that was in Roswell. No, Fort Worth, Dallas area. And everybody in the whole neighborhood came in. They, next thing they came out with bottles of champagne. They thought they made a big party out of it.
Now that was a secret mission.
I think so. It was part of a NASA type thing.
Yeah.
Oh, you've heard about that one?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Pete Gildenberg told me.
Oh, okay. I remember that basically, but that was over around Fort Worth, Dallas area.
He seemed to remember armed guards on that one. He said there was a touchy project. And they collected
I don't know. It may have been just to keep the people there from taking anything. I don't know. It could have been.
I have no idea.
So
you went out on these recoveries, either near Roswell or anywhere. Did you have orders to collect up as much of the material as possible? Was that an instruction?
Oh, sure. The instructions were that, hey, here's our gondola, and here's a balloon in the chute, get all of it, and come back.
So you would take the guide with kind of maybe if necessary.
She's going to get it in there.
Okay. Well, the guys would fan out maybe and pick up this stuff, like, you know, go out there and go out around a field and pick it up.
Normally, there'd only be four people.
Uh-huh. Normally,
there'd only be four people.
You're all wearing
our fatigues.
Right.
And we're all driving out depending on what the load is. Yeah, here it is. We disconnect. And the comm guys would went on recovery like that. We're basically through communicating now, other than with the airplane. We're not talking back to base anymore, per se. We turn up the gain on our radio, leave the door open in our vehicle. We'd be out there helping roll up the chute, the antennas, and manhandling the various gondolas into the little weapons carrier bed and tying it all down. And we're all tied down. We look around, we clean up the area to make sure that we didn't destroy or leave any trash or junk for the around, and then we'd tell the aircraft, okay, we're done with it, direct us now to the balloon. And they would direct us into the balloon, and we'd go pick up the balloon. And if there was a farmer around that came over, would you like the balloon to cover your hair or something like that? If he wanted it, we gave him. If not, there were a lot of times we would just dig a big ravine. If there was a ravine there or something like that, we would dig down and throw the balloon in and cover it up and go. But that was not too often. We would do that. But we wouldn't want to leave it around so the cows could start eating and get sick and all that. Because that did happen. I think somebody claimed that once or twice. But that was basically it. On recovery, the sole purpose was to not leave junk all over the desert. Whatever we flew normally stayed all there together, and that was it. We launched one time, the bag that I told you about, he and I, we launched a balloon from here. It was over in heat, somewhere over in here. And he and I flew on a 123, and we tried to get recovery in that night. They had their spotlights and all that, and we could not get them to the right ravine. There's a lot of ravines, so they couldn't get to it. So we came back, and we got back to Holloman about midnight, and we both got back, and they say only I was on status at the time, and I got up. Okay, guess I got to bed about 2, something like that, after we went up to the control center and briefed them and all that. And then we came back, and they called me up at 5:30. I was at the flight ops at 6, and we told them. They went out there. I flew right to the package. I was the only observer on board. It was a helicopter. And, we can't stay here. We're just dropping you off here and look around a little bit. I said, well, wait a minute. You got a guide recovery in here. That's the sole purpose of this. Well, we ain't got time. So I said, then drop me off right to the package. Now, they dropped me off of the package. There was a farmhouse down, maybe a mile. I could see the farmhouse. And I told the pilots, when you fly back over this road, because recovery's going to be on this road. And I said, listen to them on this frequency and tell them to go down to this farmhouse and then come over and I'll talk to them on my handheld. And that's what they did, and we got right to it. Back to the two farmers come up there while I was just standing there, and I started rolling up the parachutes and getting everything squared away, shutting the packages off because it was still running. You could hear the motors, clocks, and all that running. And here comes this pickup. Opened up a fence, I see him pick on, wham. I didn't think nothing more about it. He killed an eagle rattlesnake, man, and I've been messing with a parachute. They could be crawling under that all night, you know. And here they just hung it over a fence post. It must be 2.5-3 feet on either side of that fence post. I'm on the way out.
Do you remember making recoveries? You talked about some over near Roswell, in the area of Roswell. Do you remember making any over on the west side there, up near Truth of Consequences?
That's over here. TRC's over here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we made many over in TRC.
How about up north of TRC?
We had...
you remember going up near Magdalena or any of that area?
Not a whole lot. Now, we launched from north. We launched way up by down here by Carrizosa and Socorro up in that area. We launched some balloons from there.
You had a lot of remote launch sites for some of those targets.
Yeah, It'd be all over.
Mm-hmm. You guys launched all up around there, Tularosa mm-hmm. Basin up
you
there?
You bet. Especially on base, we would, what they call it, Poline Road out here. Maybe Duke told you some stories. Dave would tell the launch crew, sit down, go out there and get a, oh, hang on, no, go drive down that road 20 miles and set up and launch another one. They were small, basically small balloons. It wouldn't take a whole lot of work to launch them. And in those days, the instrumentation was not very sophisticated. And basically, they had a, you could open the valve and you could terminate it, and basically not a whole lot more.
Okay.
But that was in those days.
Well, another mission I'll ask you about was the Viking mission.
You bet.
You on those?
Mm-hmm.
That was in the summer of, when was that?
1972.
Uh-huh.
I was in charge of the communication and instrumentation section, and I launched three of the four flights. I was at the site at Roswell.
So they launched from Roswell?
You bet. At the airport.
At the Roswell Industrial Air Center?
You bet.
Which was Roswell Army Air Field.
Yeah,
Walker Air Force Base many years ago. Okay. You were in the comm?
No, at that time it was instrumentation and communications.
Okay.
So I was in charge of the instrumentation, and we was all one shop now, and I had dedicated two people to, we had one of the big white vans that I showed you in there, and I personally headed up the whole thing, instrumentation and communications, and I would just have people out there, but it was actually hands-on.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't just walking around.
you loaned me some slides from uh-huh. some of that Viking program.
You bet. In fact, I'm in one or two of those.
Uh-huh.
And I
that
think
was a pretty odd-looking vehicle.
It looked, some people could say that looks like a flying saucer. And they wouldn't be surprised if they took 1947 and started using 1959.